The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org and healthsystemsfacts.org. Scotland is adopting new national drugs policies, committing new resources, and strongly embracing harm reduction, including supervised consumption facilities and heroin-assisted treatment. Later in the show, we'll hear Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, address the Scottish Parliament to announce those policies. But first, Don Wooten, LPN, is a nurse at the Irwin County Detention Center, which is an ICE detention center in Ocilla, Georgia. She appeared recently on a webinar hosted by the nonprofit group Physicians for Human Rights.
Working at Irwin County Detention Center, I had been in and out of the facility three times. Started in 2009, went back in 2014, and then I went back this last time in 2019. Coming back this last time, it was very different. It had always been questions, but nothing that you could just kind of put your hand on to say, hey, this is going on in the facility. I had a young lady, 23 years old, was the first kind of just hair-raising experience that she had had a procedure done and she wouldn't be able to have kids and could you check into it? Long story short, I brought her back. She had had a hysterectomy that she said she didn't consent to. Her husband was going to leave her, was a sick call nurse at that time. Coming into 19 with COVID, I myself have underlying health conditions as well as children that I go home to have underlying health conditions and parents that were coming along now suffering dad, four-stage throat cancer, mom, breast cancer at the same time. And I began to ask my supervisor, we received a detainee from another facility and the warden called down and spoke with one of the nurses and told her that we're getting this gentleman. There's a possibility he could be COVID positive. We're looking at this in the beginning of February and we're receiving this individual at the facility, and she reported to the nurse practitioner, and the nurse practitioner had a meeting with all of us and said, hey, protect yourselves. This is what it is, and he instructed her not to tell anybody, to keep it to herself, but she informed the rest of us. I asked, was this detainee positive? What happened with this individual? The results were hidden. I actually found them compiled up under some other papers. And he was positive. We were told that they were not positive. I, in turn, then myself began to wear a face mask. I purchased a face mask. And it was a cloth mask. And I was told not to wear it. You don't need to wear it. We don't have COVID in this facility. Don't do that. You're going to spark a mass pandemic inside of the facility. So time progresses on and we begin to get more detainees positive. So we have numbers now that are positive. There are forms that are not being filled out with the human health department. The CDC is not being made aware of what's going on. The numbers are reporting at this time every day and our facility still says zero. And I know we have positive cases. So we're coming along the time now to where we have positive facility workers or officers at the same time, as well as positive detainees. And we're told not to report this. You know, we don't have COVID in this building. Do not go around telling people we have COVID in this building. I asked my supervisor several times, hey, are those forms supposed to be filled out? What is that? Is the health department supposed to be aware of this thing? That's not any of your business. And coming in and you see these employees sick as well as detainees sick, and you're telling me not to wear a mask. So we progressed to the time to where we're coming down the end of February in March to where the facility gets over 900 N95 masks, but they're locked in the warden's office. So it's to the point to where now, you know, you've got to ask for protection for yourself. The nurse tells me, nursing supervisor, that there are masks that are in the warden's office. You have to see the warden to get them. We're working a weekend at this point and no warden's present. He's home for the weekend. So there's nobody to allocate or allot us these masks. And I begin to ask questions and say, I mean, what is really going on? Why are we not reporting this? Hey, I have underlying conditions and we're told to keep silent. And then with that being said, I have these women that are coming to me as well. Hey, Ms. Wooten, you know, I get so many this week or so many this day to say, hey, we're having this procedures. Can you check into it for us? I sat down in the office and I was sitting with a nurse and my supervisor was adjacent to her, to us in her office. We're not being 6 feet maintained. We don't have hand sanitizer. Nothing is being cleaned. Nothing is being sanitized. One of the exam rooms is so busted you couldn't clean it. And they're coming in one behind each other. And I'm seeing the detainees making masks out of socks, cutting up jumpsuits, making masks, going to the hole for making masks, or put in solitary confinement for making masks. We sit down at the computer and she's putting in orders and she says, well, everybody that goes out to this physician has this procedure, haven't been back 2 months. And I'm like, what are you talking about? The supervisor at the time rolls her chair out and says, everybody that go to him, he do the same thing to him. It's about money. Rolls her chair back in. That was the end of the conversation. And I go to work one day and I'm demoted. And I'm knowing in the back of my mind why I'm demoted. Because I'm in a small town facility and I'm raising concerns about what we don't have, what we don't need. It's not supposed to get out into the community. We were being told at the time that COVID was a community disease. It was not a Erwin County Detention Center disease. Being in mind that we all live in these communities and we work from these communities, that it's not just a community disease, but it's Erwin County Detention Center. I enter the office, I go in on a write-up. So now there's a case being formed and I'm a no call, no show. I was out sick, had a doctor's excuse that said, do not report back to work until you're symptom free. But because I was told I was an essential worker, put on a mask, come to work. I was coming to work. The thermometer was being done by officers, 88.7. You're telling me to write down 97.3, and I've been nursing at this point 11 years, so I know better. And you have symptoms on the sheet that says you can't come to work if you're symptom-free. I asked about that. The sheet got changed and said that you can't come to work unless you've been in contact with someone with a positive case. And I said, well, that would be all of us because we're out in the community. We don't know who does what. Sheet got changed again that says that, you know, even though you have symptoms, you can wear a mask and still present to work. So after being rolled up by this time between the ladies and the COVID, and me being afraid to be sick and my physician telling me if I contract COVID with sickle cell disease, that it will be hard for me to recover. I single parent, 5 children. I want to see them raised at this point. I want grandkids at some point with these kids. And it just gets to be overwhelming. And after getting in your vehicle day after day, crying home, I have a 20-minute ride home to where when I get home, I'm raccoon-eyed. And my kids like, Mom, are you okay? It's time to say something. I shared it with a local, well, with an attorney that helps my son with special needs. Ms. Kamala Buchanan was how we got started. And she connected me with Project South that in turn, government accountability was reaching out at the same time. So we worked into that collaboration and they made it so easy to tell this story. And it was supposed to be told because it was the right thing to do. I was raised to do what was right. And as soon as it was expressed, it was hard, but it was a weight lifted because it was not just my life. Then I have to deal with my morals and I have to sleep with myself at night because I have kids and I will want the same thing, whether they were incarcerated, whether they were immigration, female, male, I would want them to be treated the same way. And a lot of the things that Ms. Katie was talking about. No hand sanitizer. You have it, but it's locked in the supervisor's office. No mask. You have them, but they're locked in the supervisor's office. And you don't have Lysol. At this point, we were purchasing Lysol and bringing it to work ourselves for protection. We're in these little close-knit fitted rooms to where there's no way to social distance. The detainees are being brought to chow, no less than elbow linked, if they were elbow length apart to eat. They were in the hallways, and a lot of them were coming sick. We still was allowing visitation at this place, even though the physician recommended that we close it down and we sanitize it, not to let anybody in, not to let anybody out. But we were still allocating visitation, and people were coming in off the streets, and people were visiting, and no one was being made aware that we actually have this inside of the facility.
That was Dawn Wooten, LPN. She's a nurse at the Irwin County Detention Center, which is an ICE detention center in Ocilla, Georgia. Ms. Wooten was demoted after raising concerns about inadequate medical care of detainees during the COVID-19 pandemic. She spoke recently on a webinar hosted by the nonprofit group Physicians for Human Rights. Find them on the web at phr.org. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org and healthsystemsfacts.org. Scotland is in the midst of an overdose crisis. Their rate of drug overdose deaths is the highest in Europe. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, recently announced that Scotland was adopting new national drugs policies. Here's First Minister Sturgeon.
Thank you. In 2019, the number of people in Scotland who died a drug-related death was equivalent to three people losing their lives each and every day. Every single one, 1,264 in total, was a human being with dreams and aspirations, talent and potential. They were all someone's mother, father, daughter, son, brother or sister. Each of them left a hole in the lives of those who loved them. They mattered. And while we can't help them now, we must do much more to make sure others don't suffer the same fate. The fact is, all of these people and those who died in years gone by were in some way failed by us. Responsibility for that rests first and foremost with government. And the failure is not just a moment in time. Anyone who ends up losing their life as a result of drug addiction is not just failed at the time of their death. In most cases, they will have been failed repeatedly throughout their whole lives. I believe that if we have the will, we can and we will find the ways to stop this happening. But doing so requires a national mission to end what is currently a national disgrace. It is a reasonable criticism to say that this government should have done more earlier, and I accept that. But I am determined that we will provide this national mission with the leadership, focus and resources that it needs. To help with this, I have appointed Angela Constance as a minister dedicated to leading this work and reporting directly to me. She will work with the Drugs Death Task Force, which is already doing very good work, and I want to take this opportunity to thank everyone contributing their time and expertise to it. Part of Angela's task will be ensuring that this work is embedded across all areas of government, but particularly in our efforts to improve mental health, tackle homelessness, and ensure a humane and responsive justice system. She will also lead work with partners across the country, and in particular with grassroots and third sector organisations. And she will ensure that we listen more to those with real-life experience of drug addiction, those who live or have lived with addiction, and also with their families who so valiantly try to support them. We will also work to tackle all aspects of this problem. The focus of my statement today is on treatment and support services, but there are many other areas that will require improvement too. For example, like many MSPs, I know that the widespread availability of benzodiazepines, street benzos, is scaring too many of our communities. That's why Angela Constance and Police Scotland are urgently considering with people from those communities what more we can do to address that issue. And we do recognise that this requires not just action to disrupt supply, important though that is, but also improvements to treatment that are necessary to stem demand. We will also do more to tackle head-on the stigma that is still too often associated with drug use. Stigma doesn't just affect people's sense of their own value, although that is in itself damaging. It also discourages people from coming forward to get the help and services they need. So we must remember at all times that people addicted to drugs are family members, neighbours and colleagues. Addiction is, of course, very often linked to poverty and deprivation, but it could affect any family, including our own. Stigma is therefore one of the issues Angela, Constance and I discussed with the Drugs Death Task Force last week. By addressing it and the silence and alienation it causes, we make it more possible for people to seek help, and I think that will benefit all of us. Last week's discussion with the task force, together with other discussions we've had in recent weeks, was hugely helpful. They have provided us with a clear sense of the issues we need to work on most urgently. We know there is a lot of work ahead. Now, today's statement can only be a start to this process. It cannot possibly address all of the issues that need work, and it cannot at this stage offer all of the answers. But I intend today to outline five key areas that will be of particular and immediate focus. But firstly, let me confirm that our actions will be backed by significant additional resources. In what remains of this financial year, until the end of March, we will provide an extra £5 million so that work can get underway urgently. Beyond that, from the start of the new financial year until the end of the next Parliament in 2026, we intend to allocate an additional £50 million of funding each year. This funding, a total of £250 million over the next Parliament, will support further investment in a range of community-based interventions, including primary prevention and an expansion of residential rehabilitation. We will also commit additional funding, if required, to improve toxicology services and enhance public health surveillance of drugs issues, which is essential to effective and timely interventions. A significant proportion of extra funding will go directly to alcohol and drug partnerships, and we expect much of it then to flow to the grassroots organisations that do so much vital work in our communities. More detail of the allocation will be set out by Angela Constance in due course, but we will adopt and expect our partners to adopt a clear focus on what works. It is important to be clear that all interventions need to be well evaluated so we know what works and what doesn't. As part of our approach, we will seek to overcome the divide that sometimes exists in public debate between harm reduction and recovery, because we think both of those things are vital. But most urgent of all is saving lives. Beyond funding, though the new funding will support all of this, there are five key areas that we need to address urgently. These include fast and appropriate access to treatment, residential rehabilitation, the creation of a more joined-up approach, one that supports people living with drug addiction to address all of the underlying challenges they face, of which drug addiction is often just the symptom, and which ensures better support after non-fatal overdoses, and also the vital role of frontline, often third sector organisations. However, I want to address at the outset the issue of safe consumption rooms. And let me take the opportunity to thank Peter Kraken for meeting with Angela and I a couple of weeks ago to share his views on this and indeed on other matters. There is strong evidence from other countries that these facilities help to prevent fatal overdoses and they encourage people who use drugs to access longer-term help. That is why we are so keen to see that model formally used here. I can confirm that we are continuing to explore how we overcome the legal barriers that currently restrict us in this respect. And while I cannot report on our conclusions of that today, it is an issue that I know Parliament will return to. However, as we do so, we will maximise what can be done now within the current law to reduce harm and stop people dying. An example of this is heroin-assisted treatment. There is evidence, again, from other places that heroin-assisted treatment reduces deaths. In addition, by taking away some of the chaos that drugs create in people's lives, heroin-assisted treatments can create the space to address other issues, such as homelessness or mental health problems. Currently, these treatments are available only to a relatively small group of people in Glasgow, where a pilot has been operating for the past year. But I can confirm today that we will make additional funding available starting in this financial year to make heroin-assisted treatment services more widely accessible across the country. The next important issue I want to address is access to treatment. Currently, only around half, and indeed according to some estimates, even less than that, of people most at risk of drug-related death are accessing drug treatment. This needs to change and fast. Part of the issue, of course, is the availability, speed and consistency of help. We must ensure that anyone who needs it has access to the type of support that works best for them, whether that is medication-assisted treatment, a psychosocial treatment, rehabilitation in the community, or rehabilitation in residential placements. For most people, of course, it will be a combination of all of these. We will therefore rapidly implement across Scotland the new standards for treatment developed by the Drugs Death Task Force. Funding will be provided for that in this financial year. The new standards, acknowledged as, I quote, a huge step forward by the Scottish Drugs Forum, set out the help people who use drugs should be able to expect regardless of where in Scotland they live. Crucially, the standards make clear that people must be able to start receiving support on the same day that they ask for it. The standards also stress the importance of people making informed choices about the type of medication and support available to them. Making help available and giving people an informed choice is an essential part of respecting a person's agency, rights and dignity. It's also an approach which is much more likely to be effective and provide people with the help and treatment they need. We're also taking steps to widen distribution of naloxone, the drug that we know saves lives in the event of an overdose. And we will also further increase the availability of a long-acting form of opiate replacement in both prisons and in the community. We'll work as a matter of urgency with experts and those with lived experience to develop firm targets in relation to treatment. I mentioned at the start that at most only around half of those who need help currently get it. Undoubtedly, even fewer will get it as quickly as they should. Improving that figure significantly so that a clear majority of people who use drugs get the treatment they need when they need it has to be central to any strategy for reducing drugs deaths. The final point I want to make about treatment is that people should receive support for as long as they need it. Services must have the resources to stick with people even when, because of their addiction, that becomes really challenging. At the moment, the number of people who drop out of support and treatment services is far too high. So we work with alcohol and drug teams to very significantly improve that over the next year. Achieving these objectives on treatment will, of course, be challenging, but it is essential and the basic aim is clear. We must empower more people to seek support. We must make that support more consistent, flexible, effective and much faster. And we must help services stick with the people they're supporting. All of this will go a long way to reducing the numbers of people who die. The third area I want to cover is residential rehabilitation. In total, around 650 people from Scotland benefited from residential rehab last year. At the moment, there are an estimated 365 rehab beds across 18 different facilities. We know that residential rehabilitation, while, and I think this is an important point, in no way the whole solution and not right for everyone, can though be an effective way of helping people with addiction. But access to it is not as readily accessible as it should be. So part of the immediate £5 million we're making available in the remaining weeks of this financial year will support the opening of additional residential rehabilitation placements. Over the course of the next Parliament, we intend to allocate an additional £20 million a year for residential rehabilitation and also associated aftercare, which is often the bit that doesn't get the same attention. We will continue, of course, to assess funding levels going forward. A significant proportion of the extra funding will go towards developing sustainable capacity in regional centres across the country. Our considerations will be inclusive of different models of care. The aim is to ensure that residential rehab is available to everyone who wants it and for whom it is deemed clinically appropriate at the time they ask for it in every part of the country. And we must ensure that rehabilitation can be provided much closer to home for people so that it is closer to the families and support networks that they so often rely on. As Angela Constance said last week, we believe that these measures will bring provision in Scotland into line with other European countries, and more importantly, they will help reduce deaths and aid recovery for hundreds of people each year. The next area I want to cover is how those working in drug services can work together better and share information more easily. One area where this is of urgent necessity is in support provided to people following a non-fatal overdose. It is a fact that many people who die as a result of drug use will have experienced non-fatal overdoses in the past. If we can provide better support after those earlier overdoses, which are themselves a clear warning sign that support is needed, then we can save lives. But that requires better cooperation and data sharing between different agencies and organisations. A good example of this kind of approach is the work being led by the Glasgow Overdose Response Team. They respond quickly to a person after a non-fatal overdose and help address immediate risks to their health while connecting them with community or clinical services in the area where they live. By making additional funding available this year, we can extend outreach initiatives like this and ensure that similar support is provided in cities across the country. In addition, by April, all alcohol and drug partnerships will have agreed a common set of steps that need to be taken to support anyone who suffers a non-fatal overdose. This will ensure that information is shared at the right time and that support is made available quickly whenever it is needed. The final point I want to address in the time I have available to me today is support for grassroots community organisations. As I said earlier, they will receive part of the additional funding that I have announced today. These organisations working on the front line, and I know this from my own constituency experience, do vital and invaluable work. But they often exist on shoestring budgets and are stretched to the limit. With extra funding, the work they do will be more secure and they will be able to do more of it and reach more people. This funding and support is important in itself, but I hope it also sends an important message that we value and support the work being done by grassroots organisations. Presiding Officer, this statement has set out a number of immediate actions. There will be more to come in the weeks ahead, but I hope it will also be heard as a statement of intent. And I hope it signals very clearly our determination to make change, to no longer fail those who need and deserve our help, but to support them instead to live their lives to the full. Right now, I spend most of my waking hours thinking about a virus, discussing and deciding the interventions necessary to protect as many people as possible from COVID. The pandemic has been all-consuming for all of us in a way that I hope no other issue will require to be in our lifetimes. But, and this is a point made already by others, this is a time to bring the same resolve, focus and common purpose that we have all shown in tackling COVID to reducing the loss of lives caused by drugs. None of us should accept drugs deaths, not a single one of them, as inevitable. And nor should we accept the heartbreak or loss of human potential that they cause and represent. Today's statement sets out new measures, it confirms additional resources, but perhaps most importantly of all, it reaffirms our resolve and underlines our belief that every single life matters. There's a lot of hard work ahead, but we are determined to make a difference and to do so quickly. We will do so in memory of all those who have died, but more importantly, we will do so to ensure that more people get the support they need to live.
That was Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon. She recently announced new drugs policies for Scotland, centred around saving lives, eliminating stigma and reducing harms. Following the First Minister's address, members of Parliament were allowed to ask questions.
Rona Mackay, followed by Monica Lennon.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. As the statement outlined, the stigma associated with drug use can prevent many people from coming forward to get the support they so badly need. Can the First Minister expand on the work that the Scottish Government and its partners are undertaking to tackle the stigma surrounding drug addiction?
First Minister.
Angela Constance and I heard a very moving presentation on the work that's been done through the task force when we attended its meeting last week. They have recently published a stigma strategy, which has a number of recommendations about tackling the issue, and they are taking forward an anti-stigma charter to challenge all of us to consider how we can work together and individually to create a stigma-free Scotland when it comes to issues of drug use. And, you know, I think that is so important. And it's important that we have strategies and charters. The work that's been done here, I think, is exemplary. But this is one area where it comes down to all of us. It is about how we talk about people with drug addiction, how we think about them, how we discuss the issues, the complex issues that are required to be taken forward and progressed here. So each and every one of us has got a role to play to remember that every single person with addiction, every single person who dies with addiction is a human being. It could be, but for a cruel twist of fate away, any one of us. And these are our fellow human beings, they are of our communities, they are of us, and we need to see it that way and make sure that we don't allow stigma to stand in the way of the help and support they need.
That was Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, answering questions in the Scottish Parliament about that nation's new drugs policies. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.